Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Between the pandemic still spreading and the presidential campaign taking shape, this is tryout time in the blame game. President Trump's contentious diplomat Mike Pompeo has walked back his accusation that the killer virus came out of a Chinese government lab in Wuhan, probably because the U.S. intelligence would not back him up. The Secretary of State now says there's evidence on that point, but no certainty. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas is still the point man among blame China Republicans. This week, Senator Cotton said the Chinese Communist Party is responsible for every death, every job lost, every retirement nest egg cracked by COVID-19. And he said that Xi Jinping and his comrades must be made to pay the price. Between Donald Trump and Democrat Joe Biden, meantime, campaign videos for both sides argue the same point, that the other guy was chummier with China and had said sweeter things about Chinese leadership in happier times.
Communist China hid their outbreak from the world, silenced their doctors, shut down investigations, and blamed America.
Labeling COVID-19 a foreign virus.
The Biden plan would protect China.
Everyone knew they lied about the virus. China. President Trump gave China his trust.
President Xi, I think you're doing a very good job.
Joe Biden on China.
It is in our self-interest that China continue to prosper.
Biden voted for job-killing trade deals with China and failed to support the China travel ban to stop coronavirus.
Trump rolled over for the Chinese. He took their word for it.
The president tweeted, China has been working very hard to contain the coronavirus.
China's killing our jobs and now killing our people.
Trump praised the Chinese 15 times in January and February as the coronavirus spread across the world.
It's a tough situation. I think you're doing a very good job.
And now, we're paying the price. All the negative ads in the world can't change the truth.
But seriously, people, what is at risk here? In a Chinese-American relationship that survived a tough trade war in Trump time, then went precipitously sour well before the coronavirus arrived. We have two serious explainers with us this hour. We'll get to the retired diplomat Chaz Freeman, who was in on the blossoming of U.S.-China cooperation in 1972 between President Nixon and Chairman Mao at their breakthrough talks. But first, Jeffrey Sachs of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, economist of global poverty, engaged for four decades now as consultant and confidant in the land where hunger and extreme poverty have receded most spectacularly, which is to say, in China.
The epidemic itself is clearly the biggest shock to global society since World War II. Secretary General Guterres said that, and he's right about that. The economic hit will be the largest since the Great Depression. And I think the social and political and ideological ramifications will also be very large. In what way? With a lot of uncertainty ahead, certainly. There's no clear, definitive path that this crisis is going to follow. But this is a big deal. It's clear now it's not going to be any kind of quick V-shaped spring back from a bad springtime to a successful second half of the year or anything like that. We're in for deep change over the next several years and a lot of crisis.
How much has been decided already, Jeff? I mean, the path toward downgrading, if not alienating, the whole relationship with China was underway for 2, maybe 3 years. Suddenly the coronavirus gives it a hook, as they say in the news business. What about the relationship to begin with?
It's been the center of Trump's foreign policy, also his domestic politics, from the campaign to his presidency, to put China in the bullseye. He blamed China for just about every one of America's ills, but
worst trade deals and all that sort of thing.
The worst trade deals and the loss of jobs and much else, and the stealing and every accusation that could be made has been made. And it was the sport of the administration for several years to prod, provoke, taunt China, and the idea growing certainly in the foreign policy establishment, and I would say in a bipartisan way in Washington, to somehow contain China. Containment, of course, was the model of the U.S. from 1947 until 1991 for the Soviet Union. It was viewed as the great success story of American foreign policy to see down the adversary in the Cold War. And as China has gained economic and technological and military strength in the last 20 years, the idea that the U.S. should contain China in the way that it contained the Soviet Union became a meme of foreign policy discourse and chit-chat, and I'd say the stuff of punditry.
Dare I say, on the face of it, kind of ridiculous. Totally different sort of history, threat, peoples.
Well, we're not the most sophisticated country in the world and not the most sophisticated foreign policy in the world. As Marx says, history repeats itself first as tragedy and afterward as farce. And there is something farcical about Trump, but there's nothing really farcical about any of this in a world of nuclear weapons. We're just always in our reality, even if we don't know it or we're only subliminally aware of it, we're always at the edge of a very steep precipice. It every day scares me in our world. Trump played with that. All of our foreign policy documents of the last 3 years have declared China to be a revisionist power. Things that are said about China are on their face shocking, that China wants to undermine every value of the international system for its own sake and so forth. Things that are really nonsensical if you have the good chance, as I do, to work very actively with Chinese colleagues, to visit China usually several times a year, to have seen my students from 25 or 30 years ago become senior officials and still close friends of mine, and not viewing China in any way as the Stalinist Soviet Union of 1947. But those are all niceties from American politics.
Well, but yes and no, Jeff. I mean, give us a little credit. You travel to China maybe more than anybody I know, but even I know that it has this chimerica quality. It's become a sort of single, gigantic, dual organism that finances and cultivates markets and technologies and science and education, as you're saying, at the highest level, more and more broadly. I mean, how do we go to war against that sort of compound?
Well, I think the main point that also Americans should know and understand is two things. It's basically some numbers. China has a population of 1.4 billion people. The United States of 328 million. China is essentially four times larger than the United States in population. It is, depending on how you measure it, maybe one-third of the U.S. GDP per person, if you measure in what we call international dollars, and something like one-fifth or even one-sixth of the U.S. GDP, if you measure in what we call current prices and exchange rates. I don't want to get into the technicalities except to say big population and still poor per capita by a significant margin. By one kind of calculation, China is bigger in absolute size, though poorer per person. In the other kind of calculation, China is still smaller, but not much smaller than the U.S. economy. Now, the arithmetic also points out the following basic fact. If China continues to narrow the gap in income per person with the United States, which is how economics works, which is more education, more skills, more technology. They catch up step by step. Then China's going to be a bigger economy than the United States. That's just the arithmetic of having four times more people. And that gives inherent angst to one U.S. idea, which is very deep in our thinking, expressed in all our documents, and that is that the United States is and has every right to be number one in the world. And the truth is, if you are, like we are, a big but not overwhelming population, we are about 4.2% of the world's population, 4.2%, you don't get to be dominant over everybody else, especially over a country that's four times larger, unless that country is somehow condemned to stay poor. Well, the truth of the matter is that's what the administration is after, even before COVID. Even before this epidemic, the U.S. idea was, let's lift all of the links on technology. Let's repatriate our foreign capital. Let's give China in general a very hard time. And that's what containment would mean. Now, it's naive on 50 different levels. One basic point of naivete is that in the American mentality, China so much depends on us for everything that if we play tough, they just won't have the technology and so forth. This is extremely naive because China develops a lot of technology. They're very sophisticated and they have a lot of other partners around the world. The world's not going to suddenly completely close up on China. Second, a lot of American businesses and a lot of American people want to have contact with China, want to do business in China, want to sell to China, want to invest in China, and so forth. So the image that we're going to contain 20% of the world population was naive to begin with. But all of this is really just a predicate for our current circumstances, which are more dangerous and very weird in a way.
Coming up, Chaz Freeman and more Jeff Sachs. This is Open Source. Jeffrey Sachs introduced me along the way this week to a remarkable writer and mind named Liu He. He is China's vice premier, also its top trade negotiator, and he may be Xi Jinping's closest economic advisor. I could understand why when I read the history paper that Liu He wrote for the Kennedy School at Harvard, where he had studied. It is a sprightly, lucid account of modern crises that changed the world. The trick in surviving those crises, he writes, is knowing that the world will be changed and then focusing on, as he says, substantial improvement in our domestic conditions.
Actually, it's a Kennedy School working paper, can be found online, called Overcoming the Great Recession, Lessons from China. And he demonstrates, as you say, a first-rate mind and a first-rate knowledge of history and the integration of economics and diplomacy. We're also talking about public health economics and diplomacy. But what Liu He says about the 2008 crisis and the 1930s crisis is, and I'll actually quote him because I have the paper sitting on my lap in anticipation of our discussion. The crises had a strong redistribution effect, which would cause shifts of power among large countries and major changes in international economic order. In other words, major economic shocks have major shifts of geopolitics. And I think that this is likely to be the case with the coronavirus shock also. This is a big one. It is bigger than the Great Recession. We don't know how it's going to play out. If by a miracle public health prevails, it'll be shorter and less consequential economically. If we continue to fail in our own country and flail around at actually controlling this epidemic and it spreads throughout the world, as many epidemiologists fear, it will be a big deal for years to come, with a long shadow of financial crisis, big public debt, and many other consequences. Hmm. But it will have geopolitical ramifications also. So far, Asia Pacific, again, China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, New Zealand, Australia, Vietnam, that region has contained the epidemic far more than the North Atlantic, Western Europe, and the United States. China is already recovering. The United States is still in a continuing decline. I think that's likely to continue through the fall because of the poor leadership in the United States. China will possibly, let's say, have positive growth this year in aggregate output. In the United States, I'd say no chance for that. So what's likely to happen is a further shift of the economic center of gravity of the world to East Asia. East Asian economies are working and ours are closed down. Now, that's one reason why, maybe, among many others, Trump is saying, well, let's open up no matter what. You can't really run an economy in the middle of a pandemic, even if you want to. You shouldn't want to. But even if you wanted to, the economy is not going to function just by declaring it's open. It's not going to be open if the virus is spreading.
Interesting. Liu He also said, fascinating to me, that in a crisis like the Great Depression or even the 08 recession or this one, what do? You take care of business at home. And you, in China's case, after 08, focus on substantial improvement in domestic conditions. And the opportunities will come.
Well, it's interesting because what have they done now after the epidemic hit Wuhan and it was very serious and growing very fast? They took decisive measures that were shocking to us at the beginning. First, Wuhan was locked down. You said, how can you lock down a city of 12 million in a quarantine? Are you kidding? And then Hubei province was locked down. Oh, my God, 60 million people. Then the whole country was locked down. You said, what? This wasn't even in the playbook. Yet within 40 days, they're reporting almost no cases. And the right wing here says, oh, it's a bunch of lies on the data. Wrong. It's the truth. They actually controlled the epidemic very substantially. And anyone that knows what's going on there knows that they're being extraordinarily careful, meticulous, and cautious in every bit of opening up. But the people are back going about their business. They're going to work. They actually knocked the heck out of this thing. They didn't flatten the curve, as is now said. They squashed the curve. They crushed the curve. It was one of those things. I didn't know you could do that, but they did that.
We're on notice. Crises, as he said, redistribute power in and among great nations. There's a warning there.
There is absolutely an alert for us. Get our house in order. Let's get serious. Stop playing around. And let's stop this pandemic at home. It will save a lot of lives, and it will be beneficial for the United States the faster we get this under control.
Chaz Freeman was present at the creation of modern Chinese-American relations. He was the young Foreign Service officer, fluent in Chinese, who served as interpreter between President Nixon and Chairman Mao when they first met in Beijing in 1972. Chaz Freeman had a legendary career after that in diplomacy and government intelligence, but he never let go of his intimate early connection with China.
Well, in 1972, President Nixon visited China, and he did so for geopolitical reasons. He saw the need to enlist China in the containment of the Soviet Union. So we were brought together by a common strategic interest. We were married, but we only fell in love later.
Interesting.
And when we did, it was, as is quite common in love affairs, mostly delusional. We did not perceive each other accurately. The deterioration in the relationship culminated in 1989, when the Soviet Union, the common enemy, disappeared, removing the geopolitical rationale for the relationship. The Tiananmen Square student uprising was suppressed, shocking Americans into the realization that China was not trying to Americanize or democratize itself. As for what has been driving the current very sharp deterioration in the relationship, you have to remember that it was the United States that initiated a trade war, shut down the flow of investment, attempted to suppress technology exports and scientific exchanges, campaigned globally against Chinese telecommunications companies like Huawei, as well as against the Belt and Road Initiative, tried to close Confucius Institutes at universities, escalated naval patrols of a provocative nature in Chinese eyes in the South China Sea. Most ominously, the understandings that have kept the peace in the Taiwan Strait have been seriously chipped away at in this administration.
I can imagine.
And now China's become the coronavirus scapegoat of choice for the Trump administration. China responded to all this with relative restraint, but it's now responding in kind. This not only fails to persuade Americans and other foreigners, but actually arouses derision and counterattacks. And the Chinese loss of self-control costs China a lot reputationally. And China, like the United States, is now gaining an international reputation for infantile name-calling, invective, and preposterous accusations. So neither side is benefiting from the descent into schoolyard name-calling. And it's going to be hard for both of us to recover the reputational losses we are undergoing.
Chas Freeman, you've been cautioning us for 2-3 years now that on the Trump agenda was a steady, gradual downgrading of the relationship with China, and it was purposeful. I never understood exactly what the purpose was. But what, if anything, does coronavirus have to do with that longer-term process? Is it a punctuation mark? Is it anything like a cause of a worsening of relations?
Well, Washington has framed the pandemic as a contest between democracy and authoritarianism. And this may be ideologically satisfying to us, to Americans, but it's inadvertently set up a contrast between our inept performance in meeting the challenge of the coronavirus and China's relatively effective performance. And I don't think the contrast is between ideologies, but between state capacity, leadership, and citizen trust in government. And we now score very poorly on all these factors. We've disinvested in government, even as societies like China, Germany, South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan have built strong human and physical infrastructure. And they've planned ahead and developed surge capacity. Their citizens value government services and expect the best of their civil servants. And some are democracies and some are not. I think among democracies, the contrast seems to be between populism that disrespects expertise and corrodes the competence of government on the one hand, and a citizenry respectful of expertise and insistent on competent government on the other. So we have basically disinvested in our state capacity. We have highly questionable and controversial leadership, and citizen trust in government is at an all-time low.
Right.
All this makes a difference. So this is a condition that is not likely to go away soon unless we get our act together, which we show no sign of doing.
Chas Freeman, the best friend I have in China, American-educated, enormously patriotic Chinese guy, a teacher, casts a different light on globalized China and now is very embittered by it. He says, for example, Trump is right about China in many ways. China freeloads on the global system. He was saying in a note to me the other day, 5 million Wuhan residents out of a population of 11 million fled the lockdown. Many traveled overseas. Why were they allowed to leave the country? Because they were rich. And in China, the rich can do whatever they want. He writes, no matter what, a kind of decoupling of America and China is coming. The world may well discover too late that China is too big to fail. American investment could be its salvation, possibly. But who knows? The global economy could collapse. What are the real complaints about this globalized China? And what's the danger in giving it up?
Well, what you've just described is a Chinese version of China First being criticized in parallel with America First. Our lack of solidarity with allies is convincing the world that we can no longer be relied upon to uphold the international order that we created. The Chinese have flourished in that order and in many ways want to preserve it even as we tear it down. But they have serious problems, among which, I think the world admires the efficiency and competence of Chinese government, but it certainly doesn't admire China's exclusion of its citizens from the right to participate in choosing China's leaders or criticizing its leaders' mistakes or sustaining distinctive religious and cultural identities like the Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
Right.
So here we are, for a whole series of reasons, we have decided to engage in diatribe against China. And ironically, of course, unlike your friend, for the most part, these attacks on the Chinese Communist Party just cause Chinese patriots to rally behind it. And of course, that is exactly the purpose of the anti-China rhetoric here. It is to cause American citizens to rally behind Mr. Trump and his administration. It's all about the election to come in November, we hope. So anyway, we have a contrast that is unfortunate, and more than unfortunate, the coronavirus is tipping us into a level of economic depression we've not seen since the 1930s. And I don't share your friend's view that American investment in China is the salvation. I think Chinese investment in the United States would be helpful. China has a surplus of funds and a budget surplus. We are in the process of greatly increasing national debt, and we have no plan to repay it. So we have an investment deficit.
Right.
China doesn't. Anyway, I think both sides are engaging in, frankly, very ill-founded and extreme exaggerated charges against each other. And this is a dynamic which leads nowhere other than to the aggravation of our problems.
Charles Friedman, you began with the marriage metaphor. It's been a prolific marriage. Children, grandchildren, incredible growth, prosperity, and good for both in so many economic measures. Can this marriage be saved?
Well, it certainly would be far better for both parties if it were saved. But I think it may have been irreparably damaged. One of the problems I foresaw with the trade war was a false assumption that somehow its effects could be compartmentalized and that it was an economic issue, not a political one.
Yeah.
Or that it wouldn't spill over into military contention. In fact, as in a marriage, the various aspects of it are inseparable. It's a whole. It's not a sum of the parts, and you can't separate the parts. And we have now begun to engage not just in economic warfare, but in political warfare, and we run a fair risk of military warfare. This is not a propitious set of circumstances. So I'm afraid this may be irreparable. In any event, we're going to emerge from the coronavirus pandemic with a very, very different world in which both China and the United States will have suffered reputationally. Leadership by either will be questionable because we will have fewer followers. And I think this is all to our detriment, not to our benefit.
Yeah. What would that man at your side in 1972, Richard Nixon, be whispering to the ghosts of Mao, the present leaders of China, about what they built and what's to be saved?
One is the pandemic. We should be cooperating, not hurling names at each other. Another is climate change. Yet another is the establishment of some sort of stable balance in East Asia, which can accommodate China's rise, but safeguard its neighbors from bullying or undue pressure. The United States, for our part, the fact that we have chosen to spend our tax dollars on efforts to engineer foreign regime change rather than on domestic human and physical infrastructure is tragic. We have seriously reduced capacity to respond to crises. I think it's turning out that the lack of foresight, planning, and the development of surge capacity can have really serious consequences. And so can lack of confidence in government. I wonder whether plutocratic populism is going to be our permanent mode of governance. I hope not.
Charles Freeman, it is a privilege to hear your take on the world. We're not alone in thinking of you as one of the great sages that ever worked and acted in the U.S. government. Thank you again for walking us through the world.
Pleasure to talk to you, Chris. I don't qualify as a sage. I'm just a geezer.
My kind of geezer. Thank you, Charles Freeman.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Charles Freeman, a legend not least for his candor. He served President Bush I as ambassador to Saudi Arabia during the Gulf War of 1990-91. During the Iraq War in 2004, Charles Freeman said President Bush II had no feel for the style or the substance of global leadership. Coming up, the acronym WMD still ringing in Jeff Sachs' ears. This is Open Source. What's bothering our friend Jeffrey Sachs, it comes clear, is the sense that he's seen this movie before and he knows how it ends. It's about bending the truth, trampling the truth at the highest levels of the U.S. government. It happened famously in the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations, which Jeff Sachs respected a lot more than he respects the Trump government. But he says there is always a very high price to be paid.
Now, the facts are, of course, the epidemic did arise in China, but the claim against China is that China was either deliberate or recklessly negligent or engaged in a massive cover-up of what really happened. And depending on the hour and the day, some variant of the charges have been made. Some speculated or put into circulation as a trial balloon, perhaps. You never know with such things, that this was a bioweapon deliberately made by the Chinese. Somebody in China, one spokesman in China, reciprocated by saying it was made by the U.S. Army. Neither of these is true.
The top U.S. intelligence is not confirming that weaponized theory.
Yeah, and not only not confirming, they are confirming that it is not, in the sense that what the biologists have learned about this virus is that it's unexpectedly infective. It has a way of latching onto its receptor and entering cells and thereby infecting us in a way that was not known and not expected, meaning that it would not be the target of a bioweapon. And there's no trace in the genome that there's any artificiality in this. It's both unexpected and like a bat coronavirus in a way that essentially has led to, I would say, unanimous scientific view. This is not a human construction. So one charge is, well, China suppressed the news of this, and that's why there's so much death around the world. And what is cited is what we know about the timeline of this epidemic from mid-December until end of January. And I believe if you look at that timeline, you don't find charges of the sort that have been leveled at all. You find the confusion of the fog of war against a new, unexpected, and deadly virus. But the gist of it is, Chris, that the charge is China knew and they hid the facts about the lethality and the transmission of the virus. And again, without going into every hour of every day and a tick-tock between the appearance of these cases generally as a first small cluster somewhere around December 20th until the WHO was notified by Chinese authorities, which was December 31, to the time that the Chinese CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, called the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, which was January 3rd, to the sequencing and unveiling of the new virus, in other words, identifying it and then sequencing it and publishing the sequence online. That came January 11. And the lockdown of Wuhan, which was January 23rd, and the declaration by WHO of a global pandemic, which was January 30th, we're talking about a few weeks from the first cases appearing in the Wuhan hospitals to a global pandemic being declared with the virus identified and sequenced and published, and Wuhan all locked down. To my mind, in the confusion, while China made obvious mistakes or local authorities made mistakes, that's a very, very quick reaction time. And what I point out is that on January 30th, when WHO declared a global health emergency, there had not yet been one death in the United States. The first death that we are now aware of, looking back at autopsy cases, was February 6th. Now there are, as we speak, 73,000 deaths. It's hard to blame China or the WHO as of January 30th, when there wasn't a single death, for 73,000 deaths now. It's rather us in the United States that failed to control the spread of this virus that really, really requires our understanding, because it's been a total, total failure of our public health system and our leadership.
Jeff, we can see it already in the Trump and Biden ads online that China will be embattled in our presidential campaign. But these things are also tested with a very, very knowledgeable international community, not only of scientists, but people who know the history and are skeptical of China sometimes, and certainly of us too. How serious do you take this notion of Pompeo and Trump and others to double down on an anti-China, anti-relationship campaign at a very sensitive moment?
What also is being alleged, it's very serious, and it's almost surely not true. It's not that there was delay, but that this virus emerged from a laboratory, not as a bioweapon, but because it was under research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which is a few miles away from the animal market, which has been presumed to be a likely focal point of the early epidemic, that it came from an animal perhaps in the market or a delivery man delivering something to the market and so forth. But the idea is, look, China was studying this virus because it didn't want to have another SARS, perhaps, which was the 2003 bat coronavirus epidemic. An accident happened, and then it hushed it up. Now, if that were true, that would be extremely serious. That would be much worse than anything we see in days' delay of this or that that's sometimes charged. That would be a deliberate conspiracy to hide the truth from the world of something of this grave danger. That is the specific charge that Pompeo is making repeatedly and doubling down on, and that Trump has said, I've seen the evidence, I've seen the evidence. To my mind, this is extraordinary. This is like in 2003 saying, we know that there are weapons of mass destruction. We've seen it. We have the evidence. It's irrefutable. This is a claim being made of a massive conspiracy by China to hide events and, as a result, to have unleashed this pandemic. Now, every expert that I've spoken to and every analysis that I've read strongly rejects this view. This virus was not being studied in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The closest virus that was enough base pairs of its genome away that it is not this virus. At the same time, there are ample cases and reasons to believe that the transmission from bats, probably through an intermediate mammal species of some kind and possibly to a wet market or maybe some other way, is the real likely source of this as a natural outbreak, which took China by surprise and horror and eventually the whole world, is by far the more likely outcome. But we have a president and a secretary of state making a deliberate and everyday repeated direct charge that China has hidden the truth and that it caused, perhaps accidentally, the release of this virus from a laboratory. Well, from the scientists I've talked to, the truth is going to become more and more clear. And overwhelmingly likely, but I grant there's always possibilities the other way, it's going to refute the president of the United States strikingly, as it will show that the U.S. message was propaganda. In the intelligence agencies, the so-called Five Eyes partners, which is the U.S., U.K., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, watching this together, the CIA, I don't know what position it's pushing, but the other intelligence agencies are not buying this. Now, the reason this matters, Chris, is exactly for the reason you said. You know, the U.S. can say whatever it wants, and in our funny internal politics, we can do whatever we want, but if this is to have any kind of desirable effect other than humiliating and undermining America's own leadership, there has to be some truth to this.
Yeah.
And so it's a bizarre moment in my view. Now, you and I have both studied a lot of history and presidents of the United States state bald-faced lies for a living. One era, the Cold War era, when the Soviets shot down our spy planes, the U-2 spy plane, Eisenhower said famously, "No such thing as a spy plane. This was a weather forecasting plane that went off route from Turkey." Dead lie. And then Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, delivered live and on stage in an extraordinary televised moment, the pilot and the wreckage of the U-2 flight. And the U.S. president was caught in a complete dead lie.
I remember his name, Gary Powers.
You got it.
Right?
And then, you know, a few months after that was the Bay of Pigs invasion, a CIA-led invasion of Cuba. And John F. Kennedy, unfortunately, in his early days in the presidency, said in a bald-faced lie, "We had nothing to do with it." And Nikita Khrushchev really came down hard and said, "Do not lie to me again twice in 6 months. Stop it already." But the reason I mention it is these things have consequences. One of the consequences of all of this, indirectly and through mistakes and terrible misjudgments of the other side also, was the Cuban Missile Crisis that came in October 1962. So if you lie, if you cheat, if you make false accusations, they can come back in a very serious way to haunt you.
Jeff, come back to the overall reality, the logic, the danger of a China-U.S. split around the coronavirus.
If China really is demonstrated to have the perfidious intent, cheating lies that are being alleged, this would have very, very adverse consequences for China, and it would redound to American geopolitical influence for sure. And so the stakes are very high from China's point of view as from the U.S. point of view. If, on the other hand, what we're hearing is essentially what we heard, say, in 2003 when Bush and Cheney wanted a war with Iraq and essentially pushed false ideas as truths, the consequences then are very, very bad for the United States. So it's not just a question of a breakup of the two. It's really a question of how and why. the United States could be on a deliberate breakup with China because we have a populist, nativist, demagogic president. That's how I would characterize Trump. And if he wins re-election, he will continue on this course. And we could have a breakup for that reason alone. And it could come with lots of charges about Chinese perfidiousness. But, Chris, if that's the way it happens, and the charges are not true or so unlikely and without the evidence to back them, it won't bring the rest of the world along. And so that will isolate us more than China. And that, I think, is the crucial point. We are one country, China is a second, and then there are 191 other countries in the United Nations, many very significant. And even though China's large and the United States is large, together we constitute about 1/4 of the human population. And the swing vote is 3/4 of the human population. If the United States is seen to be belligerent, buffoonish, telling lies, and so on, well, we end up in a deep mess because we also depend on reputation. We depend on our ability to do business in the world. We actually depend on our ability, believe it or not, to help lead other countries. And if our leadership is defunct, our credibility is crushed by Trump, that would come at very high cost to us. So I have to think that the outcome of this matters on the facts. Just like in 2003, I thought, okay, I didn't believe a word that they were saying, I have to say. And a lot of people did believe what they were saying when Colin Powell went to the UN and made his presentation about U.S. intelligence. I happened to be on television that night, and I was said, Mr. Sachs, are you doubting General Powell? And I said, I guess I am. I don't believe a word of it. It mattered because it gravely weakened the U.S. that not only did we go to war, but we went to war over false premises. And the same thing applies here, but at an even more important scale. If we pursue our course on attacking China, but on false premises, we don't have anyone else behind us in the parade or a few weak countries that we can cajole. But we don't win the public opinion. We don't win the diplomatic opinion. We don't even maintain our possibility of guiding global events. And so the consequences, I think, would be extremely serious and adverse for the United States. Yes, breakup, but not a breakup of the world system, a break of the U.S. with the world system. That's quite different from a U.S.-led grouping. That's not even a Cold War. That's just an embarrassment and a cost. Europe is a kind of swing vote in one sense, to use probably a bad simile. But if the Europeans say, God, Trump is, what are they saying? There's just no evidence for it. It's ridiculous. And Europe and China continue on their way. Well, the consequences are hugely adverse to the U.S. as well as to global stability. If it happened that the charges are correct that the administration is making, well, then you'd have Europe and the United States and Canada and Australia, New Zealand and Japan and Korea all saying to China, you have to clean up your system. Look what you have done to the world. That's a quite different outcome. And that's why facts matter in this. It's not merely a bilateral issue. This is a global issue.
We're on notice. Crises, as he said, redistribute power in and among great nations. There's a warning there.
There is absolutely an alert for us. Get our house in order. Let's get serious and let's stop this pandemic at home. It will save a lot of lives and it will be beneficial for the United States the faster we get this under control.
Jeffrey Sachs, always a lesson, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Always wonderful to be with you, Chris. And boy, the times are interesting. So thank you very much for the discussion.
Thanks also to Chaz Freeman. Please think of supporting Open Source. The best way is on Patreon. Subscribers can hear Adam Coleman's interviews on close reading in a time of social distance. This week, the singer-songwriter Suzanne Vega
on her classic song of isolation, Tom's Diner. To hear it, go to patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.